I'm afraid that I will pass on my evil, the root of my sins. He cannot hold Passover in my house, Romilius. He cannot. It would not be right, and it can only bring shame upon him. But I was too confused and perturbed to say anything. I simply told him about old Saul, who can always be found near the Damascus gate early in the morning. If you give a message to old Saul, he will bring you to my house, and I shall make all things ready for you, I said. I must now speak to old Saul and instruct him to turn away Jesus or any of his followers. It would be a terrible scandal if he came to my house. If he did, and if it were known, then the disagreements he has with the Pharisees and Sadducees would be multiplied by hundreds. I became so upset by what he was asking that I began to weep, and he tried to comfort me so that I blurted out what was troubling me. My whole life is founded upon the sins of the flesh, Master. I would like to follow your way and spend my time according to the commandments and the law of God. But if I try to do that, how can I live? It is sin that puts bread in my mouth and clothes on my back. He told me what he always says, "Go and try not to commit the same sin again." I repeated what I had already told him. "Lord, I shall have no bread for my mouth and no clothes for my body if I cease to commit these sins." All he did was repeat what he had already counseled me. "If you trust in God, he will provide for you," he said. Then Martha came bustling into the room, and he was dragged away to adjudicate between her and her sister yet again. There was nothing else left for me but to return to Jerusalem. As I was leaving the house, Simon Peter called me back and asked what I'd been saying to the master. I told him, and he shook his head. "We are in turmoil, Naomi. Jesus is convinced that he must be in Jerusalem for Passover, but we think it is most dangerous." He looked at me long and hard. "Yet there is one way in which he could be kept safe." I wanted him to instruct me in this one way, and I said so. Then Simon Peter took me by the arm and drew me outside the house and to the rear, where we sought shade under a tree from the afternoon heat. "There is a man named Joseph who comes from the city of Arimathea, and who in secret has been a disciple of Jesus." I did not know where Simon was leading me, so I asked what was wanted of this man, Joseph. He told me that Joseph was close to members of a sect of our religion called the Essenes. Now, these Essenes separate themselves from the world. They live together as groups, and their lives are dedicated to the law of God, to prayer, and to healing. They are strict with themselves and each other, but they carry with them an abundance of love. These things Simon Peter knew and told me. He says that the Essenes live and judge each other only on their love one for another. They grow what is needed in the way of food and keep animals for the benefit of the group as a whole. Simon Peter asks that you, Centurion Romilius, go and look for Joseph of Arimathea, and when you have found him, you must ask if he will go to a community of Essenes and plead with them to take and hide Jesus among their people, if this is needed. So, Charlie thought, Joseph of Arimathea, that sudden, unexpected figure who appears in the Christian Gospels as the man who offers to bury Jesus in a tomb already prepared for himself, is now being linked to the Essenes in some grand plot. Ideal people, the Essenes, sort of a Jewish monastic order, except the sexes were not segregated. There were several communities around Palestine at the time of Christ, including one near the Dead Sea, close to where the famous Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered. Charlie knew this because he'd read an article on the Essenes. Very well read, Charlie Gauntlet. He did not know everything about Joseph of Arimathea, of course, but who does? Even Christians who have read of him in the Bible sometimes do not know what significance is attached to Joseph's offer to take charge of Jesus' body after the crucifixion. The burial was not an easy business, for it was almost Passover, and the Jewish laws concerning dead bodies were explicit. And yet Joseph did what was necessary. More, he had carefully prepared a tomb against his own death, and this he gave freely and used for the body of Christ. Charlie probably didn't know the rest, didn't know that all four Gospels tell of this secret disciple, and how later writings put him close to the Virgin Mary at the time of the Ascension. They also finger Joseph of Arimathea as the patron of the English holy site of Glastonbury, where Joseph's staff is said to be the root for a sacred thorn bush, thrusting this good, righteous, and rich disciple into the heart of the Grail legend. "Go at once, my lord. Do not delay, for he is coming into the city as soon as the Sabbath is over. I pray you to have this man, Joseph, meet Simon Peter as soon as Jesus is within the city walls. Who knows what will happen when he arrives? I hope fervently that one of these groups of Essenes will protect him should it be necessary." They came for Charlie at around 3 in the morning, the same couple of bruisers who'd brought him back from the chapel. He was dozing uneasily, for the latest developments in Naomi's tale had left him in a dubious, indecisive mood, as though he were on the brink of some world-shattering discovery, which in a way he was. Fuddled with sleep and bewildered by the cold, he was totally unprepared for the pair of religious bouncers. They hoisted him up, screwing one arm behind his back, causing a burst of pain that took him back to the viciousness of childhood bullying. This had been a favourite tormentor's trick. Hands around the wrist, then the arm pushed behind, high up the back, so that you did anything asked of you and went anywhere you were told to go. Later, this would be incorporated with the Chinese burn, a twisting of the wrist's skin in 2 different directions. "We'll give you a Chinese burn and a penny stamp," were words that had filled the 9-year-old Charlie Gauntlet with dread. The penny stamp was a crushing boot to the foot. As he was frog-marched along the cloisters, Charlie Gauntlet felt faintly ridiculous. You could never call Charles an ostentatious person, yet his height and build made him prone to pomposity, and as they took him wordlessly toward the Father Superior's study, he forced down half-formed pompous remonstrations, until he began to wonder at the idiocy of the situation. Violence had never been part of Charlie's make-up, for he'd never been pushed into using force, nor did his work call for it. Yes, at times during interrogations, a subject had become physically out of control, but at those moments someone else had always been able to assist. The same was true on the rare occasions when he'd been forced out of the office and into the field, or into those shrinking parts of the world that were regarded as the field. In his last decade of employment by the Foreign Service, Charlie had made 4 trips to Belfast, 6 to Paris, and 2 each to Hong Kong and Kuala Lumpur. The glamorous world of foreign travel had not been loaded in his favour, and he rarely enjoyed those times, for they were always hedged about with sly little routines that kept everyone on their toes.